Coming up, we get S. Barahini from The Athletic talking about a busy weekend in the NBA. Quick note on this week, we're going to have three episodes. We're going to have a show on Wednesday because I'm going to be in New York recording some shows there, so you'll hear those. And then on Thursday, we got my episode of Draft Class with Tom Haberstroh also coming back on Thursday. So three episodes this week. Busy week on the Kevin O'Connor Show. Looking forward to it. Here's S. Barahini. All right, joining me to discuss a big weekend in the NBA, S. Barahini. S., how are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Yeah, it feels like there's always a big weekend in the NBA, you know? It was quiet, and then Sunday was crazy. Friday with the Wemby-Steph game was unreal. Good time for basketball right now, man.
I know. This has just been such a fun season. Just so many fun, interesting teams, different styles of play, absences that are leading to opportunities for different players, and we're going to discuss a lot of that. Let's start off with a game I want to play. Too far or not far enough? I'm going to make a statement, S, and I want you to tell me if that statement is going too far or not far enough. And let's start with the Atlanta Hawks. So the Hawks, they're 7-2 without Trae Young. They had a 22-point fourth quarter comeback on Sunday against the Phoenix Suns, and that completes a West Coast road trip sweep for them. They beat the Clippers, the Kings, the Jazz, and the Suns. So the Hawks, are the Hawks better without Trae Young? Is that too far or not far enough?
That's a very, very good question. I'm tempted to go not far enough just because of how good they've played and because of how different their style has been offensively. If you look at what they've been doing, they are number two in how efficient they are scoring out of cuts. The New York Knicks are the number one team. Shout out to Mike Brown, who has changed their offensive scheme. But the Hawks are very, very successful at finding cutters. And a lot of that is because of the guy that you just saw, Dyson Daniels. He has taken helm of being sort of the lead guard with Trae Young out. And I love what he's done in terms of setting guys up, especially out of like secondary actions. So Jalen Johnson will initiate, and then they'll swing it to the second side for Dyson Daniels to create something. And he always knows how to do something in a pinch. So I'm tempted to go not far enough because I think they found a recipe, especially defensively. I mean, you just saw it there, but they've been the second best defense in the league without Trae. They have so much size on the perimeter between Daniels, between Jalen Johnson, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, who had a really great game on Sunday versus the Suns. All of those guys can switch everything. And then you have Onyeka Okongwu at that back line. You have Kristaps Porzingis on that back line. There's just this philosophy defensively that makes so much more sense without Trae Young. I do wonder if we're headed towards an amicable breakup. That being said, and Kevin, I'm sure you'll like illustrate this as well. Before Trae got hurt, he was not playing his best basketball. He was shooting like 19% from three. That was arguably like the worst version of Trae we've seen. So that version of Trae, yes, they are way better then. But if he comes back and he starts playing like the, you know, all-encompassing lead guard that we've seen him be before, maybe he can fit into the system well.
You say not far enough. When you say not far enough, does that mean like you are indeed sold on this being sustainable for Atlanta and they should be looking to flip Trae? Like, is that how far you're going or what?
Look, it's just enticing because of that Pelicans pick, because they have such an easy pivot, right? And if you look at the thing is, and I'm curious what your thoughts are, but what do you think Trae Young's value is right now around the league?
Pretty low. There's just not many teams that need a point guard. It's just the reality of it. Not many teams need a point guard. Not many teams need a point guard making that much money. Not many teams need a point guard making that much money who's on the smaller end. It's just the reality of it. And I think for the Hawks, that's where if you're Trae and you're seeing the team play this way, to your point, maybe Trae comes back and he fully embraces this kind of, you know, equal opportunity system where it's different guys initiating the offense. And it's not like, I mean, I've always harped on Trae playing this ball dominant style. And like Trae's had great success doing it, don't get me wrong. But I remember watching Trae Young at Oklahoma, seeing this guy fly through off ball screens and move off ball. And I'm like, I miss that Trae. I wish Trae could bring back those layers to his game. And I mean, here's the opportunity, yes, This is the opportunity with Jalen Johnson coming along, Okongwu shooting threes, and all these guys coming along, and Dyson Daniels specifically, who's been excellent ever since Trae Young went out. There's a real poor start to the season for Dyson Daniels. Like, these numbers you might see on screen here are a little unfair. I mean, like, the on-off beginning of the season, Daniels without Trae, Daniels was not performing well. Only a 38% true shooting, only 5.2 points per game. But ever since then, the last nine games, 10.7 points per game, 6.8 assists to only 1.8 turnovers, still scoring pretty well as well. He had 12 assists against the Suns, 13 against the Lakers. And a lot of those assists are, as you described us, within the flow of the offense. I mean, it's like kick out, drive and kick. It's like a dump off pass to a cutter. It's within the flow. And that's where I look at this and I'm like, this team feels like it was built to play this way. It's just clicks together. It shouldn't always be pick and roll over and over and over. And Daniels feels like he is fully embracing this opportunity and running with it, because he was a point guard overseas, man, right? Like, he has those passing skills in him in order to do this, and he is.
Man, he honestly did some point guard stuff for New Orleans too, right? When they had their fair share of injuries, like he was running the team for a little bit too. So he's had opportunity to work as a play, like a lead guard. But the great thing, as you mentioned, is this is an ensemble. Like, Jalen Johnson is carrying the ball. He's moving it around. He's making plays. And then on the other side, you have Nikhil Alexander-Walker, who can handle the ball a little bit. There are just so many guys who, and maybe that's why the Hawks got out to a shaky start initially with Trae. These are all guys who can do stuff with the ball. And to your point, I think Trae has gotten a little bit better off of the ball over the last couple of years. I think with Quinn Snyder, he's leaned in more into being willing to be an off-ball player, but a full embrace is what they need at this point. They need him to fully buy into this style offensively. And while, look, the pick and roll, Trae is an aficionado, right? He knows how to carve up any defense when it comes to the pick and roll. That like 77 stagger play that they run for him, where he'll throw it to the second screener and then run a dribble handoff or something along the lines of that. That's become an unstoppable play. It's just that Trae needs to score the ball more efficiently. If you look at Trae's numbers throughout his career, and I just highlighted the 19%, but basically throughout his career, you can ask him or want him to be a more offensive and efficient player. Last year, it was 34% from three, 41% from the field. The year before that, it was 43% from the field and 37% from three. There's just this overall shot selection thing that comes with Trae Young that needs to be better. And I think if this Hawks offense wants to reacclimate him and kind of bring him into the fold, he needs to buy into what the system is. So I totally agree. Maybe it is too far. Maybe we need to give them time to bring Trae back, because to your point, the trade value is not at an all-time high. Maybe that's a perfect moment for the Hawks front office, because now they can re-sign Trae at something lower than that max value, and that gives them even more flexibility going forward, you know?
Boy, I'm sure the Trae side would not love that.
Yeah, of course. Of course they would.
Off all I've done for this franchise. I mean, to your point, though, I mean, that's one of the things with Trae. He has, you know, going back to the DeJounte Murray acquisition, he did share more often. It did more, move a little bit more ball, more off ball. He put in better effort on defense. He's done a lot of those little things, and credit to him for doing that. But 100%. you hit the nail on the head, S. Like, he just hasn't been a super efficient offensive player, in large part driven by shot selection and what the team has demanded from him and what he has been happy to do. But ultimately, I think if Trae embraces playing a lesser role offensively, but still being the guy who can get a bucket out of an isolation, end of the clock, that's still a valuable tool, then maybe the Hawks can find the right balance moving forward. Let's move on to the Houston Rockets. The Houston Rockets, they had another win on Sunday, a really good win in overtime against the Orlando Magic. They lead the NBA this year with a 123.4 offensive rating. Here's the statement for you. This isn't an early season blip. The Rockets do have the NBA's best offense. Too far or not far enough?
Not far enough. I love this Rockets offense. I love it. And I think it has a proven identity, because You know, as you see Reed Sheppard here cooking, he's starting to play better. I know you're really high on Reed, and he's started to figure out like the shot making aspect for him, especially in the pick and roll. But they have two offensive engines that they can work through. One is Kevin Durant, who is basically born and bred to make tough shots. Like, he knows how to make difficult shots everywhere. And then they have Şengün, who has improved as a ball handler, who is working more in pick and rolls as like, you know, he'll run like guard pick and rolls with the Rockets, or he'll run as the screener for Kevin Durant in pick and rolls. At the same time, they rebound like madmen, you know? So that is a tried and true identity for them to be able to rely on all year. So they'll, if anything, they'll have a pick and roll between KD and Şengün, right? Şengün will catch it in the short roll area where he can make plays, and they have cutters in Amen Thompson and Tari Eason once he comes back from injury. They have the shooting in Kevin Durant and Jabari Smith Jr., and Şengün can make so many good plays in that middle area of the floor. At the same time, they have Steven Adams, they have Clint Capella, guys who crash the offensive glass like crazy. And so this is a team who I think has an identity. One, everybody understands their role. Two, they know what they're good at. And three, they're willing to lean on that every single night. That, to me, is what the best offense in the NBA encompasses.
I think that is spot on. And you did take it further. They're not just scoring, right? They have just so many different layers and ways that they can play. And a couple stats here for you. You mentioned their offensive rebounding. They're number one in the NBA in offensive rebound rate, or rebounding 40% of their missed shots. That's up to 47% when Adams and Şengün are out there. And we know how much those guys can pound the boards. They had that possession against the Magic where like Şengün was battling for the board, and then he went behind the back to Adams. It was like, oh my God, these guys are nuts. Yeah. And then they're last in the NBA in 3-point attempts per game, but they're first in 3-point percentage. Like, they're taking quality shots this season. And ultimately, the big question with them during the season is, well, how do they replace Fred VanVleet? Şengün has taken a big leap. Amen Thompson doing more with the ball in his hands. The addition of Kevin Durant, maybe having a higher usage perhaps than maybe he would have if VanVleet were healthy. And then Reed Sheppard, 47.8% from 3-point land so far this season. He had the step back, Steph looking 3-pointer in the first half. He smiled on the way back to me. That was the face of a man who's like, hey, I'm starting to get the hang of this. This is starting to click for me out here. It's all of these things together that is combining where they're taking advantage of all those touches and shots that were left from Fred VanVleet. And here we are, S. These guys collectively are creating the best offense so far in the NBA. It's pretty remarkable, honestly. I think it's a little bit sooner than I would have anticipated this happening so far. I didn't expect them to click this early.
Yeah, it's also a bit of a surprise because everybody thought that they would struggle with Fred VanVleet out in terms of like guys who can create for them in the half court. But I think this is another part to this. Kevin Durant is running more pick and rolls than he did when he was with the Suns. And so he's being asked to run the ball more often. That inherently brings more attention to him as a ball handler. So they'll send two to the ball automatically because defenses don't want to deal with Kevin Durant on a switch because that's an automatic bucket. And so that creates 4-on-3 situations for Alper and Şengün. And 4-on-3 situations for the best offensive rebounding team in the NBA, that is danger for any defense. I'll bring some numbers up for you. So you mentioned the 40.8% offensive rebounding percentage. That's obviously number one in the NBA right now. But it's also 5 percentage points better than the second place New York Knicks. It's 10 percentage points better than the league-wide average. It's also 5 percentage points more than last year's Rockets team. And Kev, highest percentage of their own misses of any team since the NBA started tracking it in 1996-1997. Wow. That's absurd. They're insane when it comes to offensive rebounding. It doesn't make sense. And part of that is like every single player on that court is a plus offensive rebounder. They crash like madmen. They tag up. It's caveman's hoops. It honestly sometimes doesn't even look like basketball. Like Steven Adams will be bouncing the ball to himself off the backboard multiple times. It just works. And that's why I think this probably does look like the number one offense in the NBA moving forward.
It's just so funny how that was their best offense in the playoffs last year.
It was.
And then they had Kevin Durant and all these other guys getting better. It's crazy. And like, they really did last year find something though. And I wonder over the course of, you know, months and years, are we going to see a lot more teams say, why don't we do this more often? But I think part of it with Houston, though, as well, is that is like, you can crash the offensive boards, but you better get back on defense. And they have a bunch of hustlers on their team, a bunch of guys who play hard. And I think those things go hand in hand. If you're willing to crash the boards, you're probably willing to try hard on defense. And the Houston Rockets have those guys. But I was watching that Rockets. I tuned in like middle of the fourth quarter. And Şengün, he ended the game. I feel like his development offensively, everybody talks about, but defensively, end of the regulation, he had a big block against Desmond Bane with a couple seconds left. And then in overtime, he's defending Anthony Black, sliding his feet on the perimeter, slows him down. And then Jabari Smith comes out of nowhere and blocks Franz Wagner. And Şengün, I think his development defensively as well. This is a guy who entered the NBA, and there's questions about, well, is he undersized as a center? Can he move quick enough? Is he athletic enough? And the way in which he's improved year by year by year to be one of the anchors on one of the better defenses in the entire NBA as well, I'm like blown away by what Şengün has become defensively. And that play he had moving his feet against Anthony Black came in minute 45 of the game. He played a lot last night. And he's still energetic out there. And I mean, the dude's a bucket offensively, made big plays on that end, made big plays defensively. I just wonder how soon it is until we're talking about Şengün is like, well, where is he in the MVP race? That's how good he's been.
I like that. I like that a lot. I mean, look, he's playing.
Is that too far? Yes.
It might be too far. We'll see. Give me until game 30, and then I'll come back to you. But look, I think he's been playing all NBA basketball, and I love what you mentioned about the defense, because I think over the last couple of years, the Rockets have built the perfect defensive team around him. Like, context mattered so much for Şengün, because you saw in those plays, he's playing ultra aggressively. Yeah, he dropped back against Desmond Bane, but he's willing to stay lateral or stay vertical and sell out on the drive, because he knows, one, he has very good rebounders behind him who can crash the offense or the defensive glass. At the same time, you also have, like, he can be aggressive switching out onto players because he knows Amen Thompson is backing him up, because he knows Jabari Smith Jr. is backing him up, because Kevin Durant is there. They also have so much length around him that other guys can cause deflections. And so he can be more aggressive. He can play his own defensive style without necessarily like being out of position like he was for the first couple of years with the Rockets. So context mattered so much to Şengün being a better defensive player. And I think I wish we learned that as an NBA like fan, you know, that context matters for some of these players defensively. You see a guy getting cooked on the defensive end, like, you know, Reed Shepard is a good example for this. Reed is still working through becoming a positive defender. I think the lack of size obviously will be something he has to work through, but he has very active hands. He's very good at deflecting the ball. He's good at these like rear side contests where he'll block shots. And so how do you weaponize that within the Rockets' defensive scheme? That's part of the challenge of figuring out how some of these, you know, questionable defenders like Şengün was to start his career, like Reed Shepard is right now, how those guys fit into the NBA. Also, your point about offensive rebounding, I actually think the reason that they crashed the offensive glass like crazy is to limit transition opportunities. Because if you are crashing the glass, then teams have to pay more attention because they don't want to get battered there. And so you actually limit how often a team gets out in transition. The Raptors-Rockets game that I watched a couple weeks ago, that's exactly how it went. It was the Rockets were crashing the offensive glass. The Raptors couldn't get out and running. And the Raptors are the number one transition team in the league right now. So that's what helped the Raptors lose that game. But yeah, anyways, that I love the point about context when it comes to the defense and Şengün and how he's thrived. So. Yeah,
I think you're spot on. I mean, ultimately, the context matters. And also, I think from like a draft standpoint, I was looking back at my Şengün scouting report last night, and I noted how, you know, he hustles. He plays hard. He plays with effort and all that. And it's like sometimes I think with these defensive players, that matters more when you're looking at young players, teenagers coming into the NBA, do they play hard? Great. It's like he's always going to play hard over time through strength and conditioning programs and watching film. He's going to learn how to play with better positioning. He's going to improve athletically. His stamina is going to improve. But if you play hard, that's something that a lot of the time never changes over the course of time. And I think that's why Şengün has been able to become a pretty good defensive player. And to your point about Reed Shepard bringing him up, you know, he still might get blown by on ball sometimes. But defensively, he's still making plays in the passing lanes. He's, you know, causing deflections and steals. And, you know, even as a little guy, he's doing his best to rebound. Desmond
Bane. Yeah.
I mean, he does a lot. He does a lot defensively off ball as part of a team defense rather than as an individual defense. Enough about the Rockets. They're awesome. We've talked about them a lot on the pod. And I think their offense is definitely for real. And we'll be right back after this break. Talk about Lauri Markkanen. Lauri Markkanen this season averaging 30.6 points per game. Another big night for him this weekend. I've been thinking about Lauri. You know, you have the Utah Jazz in this situation, S, where, you know, they probably don't want to make the playoffs, but they're 5-8. They're currently the 10 seed in the standing, so they would be in the play-in if the playoffs started today. And Lauri Markkanen has been absolutely amazing. I would think, you know, if they do want to tank it out, they're going to have to trade Lauri Markkanen at some point. And another team, his value is all the way back and more than it was the last time he was involved in trade discussions. So do you think Lauri Markkanen is worth 5 first-round picks? Is that too far or not far enough?
Five. 30.6 points per game.
Shooting nearly 40% from three. He's cutting to the rim. He's banging threes. He's doing everything out
there.
He's
awesome.
5 for Lauri? Look,
I'm still going too far. Five for anybody is a lot. You know, like we talk about Mikal Bridges, who was for 5 firsts. We'll see how the Desmond Bane trade turns around. But that was, I believe, 4 firsts. And obviously the KCP salary dump, etc. But I think there is a team that should trade for Lauri Markkanen. And that to me is very clearly the Detroit Pistons. If you think about what he brings as a floor spacer, as a guy who is cutting, the Jazz offense is predicated off of ball movement and moving off of screens and handoffs. And like Lauri does it with the best of them when it comes to cutting off of the ball. His size makes him such a deadly weapon off of the ball. That's why I think 5 first is kind of crazy. Like, I think you could get away with a couple of prospects. I think, you know, Jaden Ivey. I wouldn't necessarily put Asar Thompson in the deal, but like there's probably a world in which you think of a Ron Holland, and then you get to like 2 picks, you know, maybe 3 picks if you really want to dive
no
in
way.
There. It's a lot.
I'm hanging up the phone on you if I'm the Jazz. Get out of here. Don't call back. You're not serious.
Okay,
that's what
all right, fair enough. Look, how am I supposed to take a sample of like, you know, 20 games of him playing awesome or whatever it is? And you know, this is how I would negotiate. I'd be like, look, it's been 20 games. He's played well. But, you know, not well enough for 5 first round picks, Kev.
Last year was a blip. It was a blip for him last year.
It was a blip.
He's back to the guy who won most improved player of the year, was an all-star, and more. That's what it looks like right now, and more than that, because he's doing it with a higher usage, more on his plate, and we know he's a guy that can do more with less as well. Like he's to your point, if he's playing for the Pistons or the Warriors, or one of these teams that has hopes of contending for a championship, I just think the price should be 5 first-round picks. I think Lauri is a winning player that can fit on any team and can fit immediately because of his style of play, where it's not like he's this ball-dominant guy. It's cuts. It's attacking closeouts. It's everything within the flow of the offense, and then he can do a little bit off the dribble within that context as well. I think Lauri is definitely worth that. But at the same time, if you're the Utah Jazz, it's like, are we sure that we want to trade Lauri Markkanen? Are we actually sure that we want to trade Lauri? Because he's such a good piece. And you need to have some good players in order to help, you know, facilitate development for young guys in the NBA. And so, you know, that's where I think if I'm the Jazz, I would have the price significantly high because he's only 28 years old. It's not like he's 32 at this point. And so I would only give up Lowry if it's for a massive
haul. Yeah.
A haul. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay.
I would say it's maybe not even far enough. Five firsts. Wow. Are those five firsts any good? Are they crappy first? Are they good first?
Well, okay. Let me paint this picture for you, right? So the Oklahoma City Thunder own the Utah Jazz pick, top eight protected. Okay. Mm-hmm. At this point, they would lose their first round pick. Their first round pick more valuable than trading Lowry Markkanen for, I don't know, three firsts versus five firsts, right? Because you're playing with the chance that, I don't know, let's say OKC ending up with the ninth pick or the 10th pick this draft. That's crazy. So do you want to do that doomsday scenario or... that's what I would say if I was the Utah Jazz. It's like at some point you do have to pull the plug on this season. Mm. And if Lowry is playing like this, you probably will get a haul. Will it be five firsts or will it be a couple of prospects, a couple of picks, and you call it a day? I don't know. Just something to think about.
It just blows my mind that there's a chance OKC could have two top 10 picks.
It's insane. Yeah. It's
insane. The Clippers, they get the ninth best odds.
They
could have 1-9.
That's insane, man. That doesn't make sense. The NBA needs to step in and, you know, maybe I don't know what they have to do with this whole aspiration Kawhi deal, but that they got to step in again and stop the Clippers from being bad at basketball. This is bad.
Oh my God. It's so crazy. I was talking to an executive over the weekend about this and he's just like, it's not fair. It's not right. I can't believe what Presti's done.
Oh man. Someone made it similar to like the Lakers in the 80s when they ended up getting a top pick, even though they were, you know, contending, heading to the championship basically every year, and they ended up with the top pick and still ended up, you know, contending throughout and extended their championship window. That kind of feels like what OKC has the opportunity to do this year, which is just, like you said, man, unfair.
I mean, OKC could be the first team to win the NBA Cup, win 70 mm-hmm. games, and win the NBA Finals. And I think a team, I've always said, a team winning like the triple crown, right? Like win the cup, best regular season record, and win the NBA Finals. The first team to do that will be the last team for some amount of time. It could be 15 years from now. The last team, the last time an NBA team did all three. Like it could be that. That's what would give the NBA Cup meaning at some point down the line. But we'll see. OKC actually has to do it, or somebody has to do it first before that actually becomes a thing. Let's move on to a former NBA Cup champion. The Los Angeles Lakers. LeBron James assigned to the G League. He's now back assigned to the Lakers. It seems like he could be returning very, very soon this week. LeBron's fit with the reshaped Lakers will be clunky. Is that too far or not far enough, S?
I'm going to say too far here. LeBron is one of those guys who is going to buy into whatever they're doing. At the same time, Lakers are dead last in transition frequency. They're a bottom five transition efficiency. And J.J. Redick actually mentioned this in one of his post-game clips where he's like, we don't have LeBron yet, and LeBron is our number one source of transition offense. And so they are going to get so many easy buckets because of LeBron James. And that's natural just because he is one of their best leak-out guys in transition. We saw early last year, too, when Luka joined the Lakers, that those hit-ahead passes between him and LeBron were just a deadly connection. It was an automatic bucket every single time. That's something that they will immediately get once LeBron is back. Now, I will say, in the half court, LeBron will cannibalize some of the usage of Austin Reeves and Luka Doncic, and that probably will have a little bit of a – there will be speed bumps when it comes to that. How do you figure out how Austin Reeves works off of the ball? I think Reeves has shown that he is exceptional off of the ball, truthfully. Like he's been able to buy into different roles throughout his career, so he'll be okay. How does Luka and LeBron look in a half-court setting? That's the biggest question that I have for them. But in terms of how he fits, might look wonky for a couple of weeks, but they're going to start running like madmen just because LeBron is on the court.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. He's going to fit. He's LeBron James. It's just, and he also has become an elite shooter. off the catch. It's not like he's going to be a 33% guy off the catch and having to play off of Luka and all that. Like, it's going to be a pretty seamless transition. And plus, he's played with those guys before as well. He's not a new acquisition. So I'm not overly concerned there. I do look forward to seeing how they balance the load for Luka and Reeves and LeBron, though. Does LeBron take even more of a backseat? That's very possible. I wouldn't rule that out entirely. Would you? I mean, like, I think LeBron maybe putting him even more on defense and a little bit less offensively on his plate. I think that could be a good thing for him as well.
Yeah. Well, now that they have a center in DeAndre Ayton, like, he doesn't have to play that nominal center thing anymore. He's been awesome. He had a great game against the Bucks too. And I think that was the one thing with LeBron last year. You could even hear it in his post game clips where he's like, I don't think I want to do this small ball five thing for the rest of my career. So Ayton is in now. He doesn't necessarily have to be the backline defense protecting everything. He can just be one of the best defenders on the team. At the same time, like, you think about what they do offensively. I think they'll probably stagger LeBron and Reeves together and have Luka run his lineups by himself. That way you can kind of spread out some of the offensive usage. So LeBron will have his lineups. Reeves plays well off of the ball, especially next to LeBron. Those are successful lineups altogether. Then you have Luka-led lineups with Rui and Laravia and Ayton, and those guys can have their bread and butter offense. And then those guys kind of come together towards the end of the game with LeBron, Luka, and Reeves cooking. So I actually think there will be a better formula for them offensively. It's just about, like you said, does he have, like, are they going to load manage LeBron? Are they going to be like resting back to backs? I feel like they probably will. You know, they have the luxury of doing that now with Luka Doncic. He doesn't necessarily have to play every single game. You save him for April, May, and June, right?
Yeah, I think you should. I think so. Yeah. Also, he's, you know, coming back from some type of injury. And yeah, sure, sure. I can see them managing his load.
Yeah, at my age, sciatica? Yeah, no. Yeah.
I felt that once many years ago. I think in 2018, after a long flight, I was like, what is shooting pain down my leg? And it was there for like a week, and then it was gone. Nothing ever since, thank goodness. That back pain is a serious thing. But let's move on to the next category here with early season overreactions. So I'm going to ask you a series of questions, and I want you to tell me, is it an overreaction or not? And let's start off with the Nuggets. The Nuggets so far this season have the number 2 defensive rating in the entire NBAS. They have the second ranked D rating so far, up from 21st last year. During the Jokic era, their best defensive rating was 8th during the 23-24 season. Is it an overreaction to say Denver has the best defense of the Jokic era?
I don't think so. I honestly don't think so. I think this is the best defense that Jokic has had around him. One of the reasons is because they are playing more zone than they ever have with Nikola Jokic. I looked through this on Synergy. They have about 6.1 zone possessions a year. That's a game, 6.5% of the time they're spending in zone. That's not a lot. Like, you look at it, the Houston Rockets, they have nearly 18 possessions of zone a game. They are near the top of the league. They're number 1 in the league in terms of zone frequency. But Denver is 5th, and that's the highest they've ever been. That's the most possessions they've ever ran in zone with Jokic on the team. And I think a lot of that, if you look back at the OKC series, they figured that out last year. They said, like, hey, we're sitting in this zone. We're going to force OKC to beat us with perimeter shots, with outside shooting. And that's how they forced 7 games against a juggernaut team. I think David Adelman, figured out, hey, this is actually something we can lean on defensively all throughout the year. We're going to force teams to try and beat us with outside shooting. They are getting a little bit lucky in terms of opponent 3-point shooting, but at the same time, they have found a system that works for them. They've also found a system that allows Jokic to basically camp in the paint as the low man. Same thing with Jonas Valanciunas. Like, you're not forcing these guys to play aggressive pick and roll schemes, showing and recovering. You're allowing them to sort of sit in the paint and use their size and length as defensive rebounders. And so I do think this will be the best defense of the Jokic era, just because they found a new wrinkle to themselves identity-wise, and it's that zone defense.
I think that's definitely true with Denver. It's the scheme with more zone. It's the fact as well, Jokic himself has continued to improve as a player. Everybody talks about his all-world offense, but and I saw a great clip of Paul Pierce on his new show with Wozni Lambre. And I think Paul Pierce, you know, he said it was his first time seeing Jokic in person in many years. And he remarked about why he's amazed at the defender Jokic has become, always in the right position, constantly communicating, talking, playing hard. And it's true. Jokic has become a great defensive player as well. He's not the guy who was a liability many, many years ago. And I think it's the scheme, Jokic's improvement, the roster as well. And, you know, guys like Aaron Gordon, great defensive player. Guys like Peyton Watson, very good. Bringing back Bruce Brown. I mean, having Valanciunas as a backup behind Jokic as well. He's no great defensive player individually by any means, but he's a lot better than what they've had. And he can play in that scheme. And so I think all of these things combined, it's pretty amazing, though, as with the zone aspect, what a change of head coach can do for you. You know, they went from Michael Malone, who is more of like, you know, the rah-rah vibes guy, you know, pushing the team and all that, to the tactician, the X's and O's nerd type and Adelman. And it's just changed the complexion of a team in the way that was very necessary. And I think they don't go to seven with Malone. I'm not like, I think Malone deserves another head coaching job at some point. I think he's a good coach, but he was no longer the right coach for Denver. Now it's Adelman. And this team just feels like they just have so many more layers to their personality than they did under Malone. And Adelman seemed to be, you know, for many years, he was always hyped as like, oh, yeah, one of the best assistants in the NBA. And, you know, then you get an opportunity and he's showing why. He sure is, I'd say.
Yeah. And look, to your point about the depth, like you look at all across the NBA right now, good defensive teams are deep teams in the NBA. Like you have to be able to play in shorter stints, give all out effort. And that allows Nikola Jokic to do the exact same thing, right? This depth you mentioned with Bruce Brown and Tim Hardaway Jr. and Peyton Watson and Jonas Valanciunas, all those guys contributing actual minutes to this team instead of piecemeal minutes here and there for when Jokic comes back on the floor, it actually gives them a baseline of competency on the defensive end that they just didn't have before. I was looking at the numbers before this, but so the Nuggets without Jokic this year have a minus 1.6 net rating. It's like, all right, okay, they're barely losing their minutes. You know, last year it was minus 10.86, and then their championship year was minus 14.8. So they are surviving the Jokic minutes. They're not necessarily winning them, but they're surviving. And that's really changing the dynamic. It's also allowing them to exert more effort defensively, which is why I think they actually will have the best defense they've had in the Jokic era.
Oh, yeah, I think so as well. And, you know, they definitely have the best backup in Valanciunas, that's for sure. that's without a doubt. And that makes a big difference. And I think to your point of what you're saying with depth, if the team is having more success offensively without Jokic on the floor, they're then therefore forcing more half court opportunities for the opponent, which helps your defense as well. You know, it's a whole cycle, and that's why. We'll be right back. Scotty Barnes and your Toronto Raptors, 8-5 so far this season, winners of 3 in a row. Is it an overreaction to say Scotty Barnes is an all-star once again?
Oh, Kev, you know I'm not going to say it's an overreaction.
You might say it's an underreaction. You might say he's all-NBA.
I mean, to be honest with you, I think he has been playing all-NBA level basketball because of how good he's been defensively. He is now the only player in the NBA averaging over 1.5 steals and 1.5 blocks. You know, I think the fact that he is, in a lot of ways, his life has become more simple with Brandon Ingram on the floor. I was looking this up this morning, but he is being assisted on more of his shots than he ever has in his career since his rookie year. So he is, I think it's nearly 65% of all of his shots this season have been assisted. A lot of that is because he's being more of a play finisher in their actions versus being the guy creating the shots. But at the same time, he's also still able to weaponize his secondary creation, sort of like what we mentioned with Alperen Şengün, where they'll get Scotty to catch it in the middle of the floor. And because it's a 4-on-3 situation, he's so good at, one, attacking a tilted defense, and two, making cerebral plays with it. As you see here, you know, the dump off passes to Jakob Poeltl and finding cutters. Like, this is the type of offense that Scotty could live in. But at the same time, and I'm curious to get your thoughts, he has been the only stopgap for them defensively. He is plugging all kinds of holes for them on the defensive end. I can't tell you how many times I've watched him completely erase a wide open layup this season, where he'll just, like, the Sixers, the Rockets, whoever it is that they're facing, will have gotten a wide open layup and Scotty will recover out. He'll use his length to get there. I think not only is he on pace for an all-star spot, but I think he's on pace for an all defense spot. And if you put those things together, honestly, I think he's playing all NBA basketball right now.
Yeah, but he's been sensational. I mean, you mentioned it, like, the fact a lot of his shots unassisted, still doing his typical thing offensively as an on-ball guy as well. Like, we showed some of the clips on screen with the pull-ups, short roll, playmaking out of those situations, playing within the flow. And I think with Scotty, defensively, that's part of it as well, that immense frame and length and versatility that he has and the effort that he brings to the floor. With this Raptors team, one of the concerns people had about them entering the season was, I think there's a lot of people who thought, okay, this team should be good defensively, but there's questions about the offensive fit. What's been your early season assessment about the fit of this roster so far?
They have really thrived with their bench groups. The Sandro Mamukelishvili, Jamal Shedd, Grady Dick trio has injected life into this offense. And so it actually provides them with a lot of good looks. The Raptors starting lineup is trending in the right direction, but over the last couple of weeks, whenever they've inserted one of those guys, their offense starts to skyrocket. And part of that is because of spacing. Part of that is because they're comfortable going to small ball five looks because Scotty is such a talented help side defender and can block shots and kind of be that second fiddle next to Mamu on that backline defense. So he can, one, be your nominal small ball five while also being able to push the pace in transition. They play extraordinarily fast. They're number one in the league in terms of transition frequency. And so that's helped churn out their offense. At the same time, I will say they are a top six half court offense right now. And a lot of that has to do, it exceeded my expectations too. I did not expect this, to your point, Kev.
That's like, for sure. I didn't see this coming.
Yeah. I did not see this coming either. I thought, like you said, I thought they would be a good defensive team that would have to figure things out on the offensive end. But honestly, it's been the opposite. They've been a really good offensive team that is trying to figure out how they're going to survive defensively.
It's crazy.
I think part of that is because they just have a lot of different options offensively. The guys are pretty unselfish. They like playing with each other. So, you know, RJ Barrett can get downhill. He's had a really great start to the season, finishing at the basket more frequently. Brandon Ingram is sort of their release valve on offense. So when all else fails, they'll go to him in the pinch post area and he can get a bucket. But they have a tried and true philosophy offensively, which is similar to the Golden State Warriors and the Utah Jazz, which is, we're going to run off cuts. We're going to dominate in terms of, like, moving off of screens. They really, really, like, they are doubling down on, hey, we are going to get as many easy shots as we possibly can in the half court. And it's really been successful. So they look good, man. They look good. I don't know how good they'll end up being throughout the rest of the season, but they have an easy schedule moving forward. There's a pretty big opportunity for them to climb up the standings early on.
Yeah, I think so as well. I mean, look, the East is weak and we're going to see some, you know, teams that are kind of in the middle, you know, no disrespect to Toronto, but like, you're not a playoff team in the West. In the East you are, and you're going to see some teams get opportunities to make the playoffs and who knows, maybe make a little noise or at least get playoff reps for a lot of your young guys. And to me, Toronto looks like a team.
I'll add something here. I wonder if they end up being aggressive if they see an opportunity. You know, we just talked about Lauri Markkanen. I would be very, very, maybe not Lauri Markkanen because, you know, apparently five first, but I'm curious to see. I'm curious to see if they get aggressive because They're also a team that's above the tax. They sort of have to make a trade in February to either get under the tax or to double down on what this team is. If they are in a position to make some noise in the East, I'm very curious if they do something aggressive.
I could see that as well, because it feels like a roster that has there's a foundation. It's just missing that superstar. And maybe Barnes becomes that. Maybe he does. Yeah. But I think Barnes is more of a number two. That's the way I think of him. And so if maybe you have multiple number twos and then you put yourself in a position where, you know, the team can make a little bit of a run. But ultimately, I do think they're a team to watch, as you said. And we have the Eastern Conference standings on screen right now. Pistons leading the way at 11-2, Knicks at 8-4. We're going to talk about them with a third episode this week on Wednesday that we'll be publishing. And Cavs in third at 9-5, Hawks at 9-5, Raptors at 8-5 so far this year. They're currently in the 5 seed. We shall see. We shall see if this continues. The Philadelphia 76ers, currently the 6th seed in the Eastern Conference at 7-5. Is it an overreaction to say that Philly is now Tyrese Maxey's team, not Joel Embiid's?
Not even a little bit. It's not even a little bit of an overreaction. This is an underreaction, if anything. This has been a long time coming. I remember watching a game a couple days ago. I think it was actually against the Pistons. Tyrese Maxey was at the free throw line. And I think it was the first time I heard MVP chants for him at the free throw line. Maybe it's happened before, but it was at least the first time I had caught it. He has been awesome. He is now their guy. He is their franchise player. Everything revolves around Tyrese Maxey. The improvements that he's made as a playmaker, understanding how he can use his pace, both how quick he is, but also how he can stop and go in certain situations and pick and rolls, it has been electric. The Sixers' offensive scheme really relies on three or four different guards being able to create off of the bounce. And Maxey is one, so good at attacking tilted defenses, but he's also really good at setting up other guys because of how great he is getting downhill. So he'll get downhill. He'll find VJ Edgecombe. Defense is in rotation. Edgecombe can attack that tilted defense. Quentin Grimes, same thing, can attack that tilted defense. Kelly Oubre, before he got hurt, could do the exact same thing. So they have built this Sixers team for better or worse, in Maxey's image. And I think whatever run they get from Joel Embiid, whatever run they get from Paul George, is now hopefully an additive. I know George is going to be coming back soon, so we'll see how he looks with this group. But to me, there's no question that this is now Tyrese Maxey's team. And I think the Sixers, if they had the opportunity to pivot, because I don't think they can. I don't think they can just go out and trade Joel Embiid. I don't think they can trade Paul George. If they had that opportunity, they probably would, because they've found this new group that, one, is really entertaining to watch, and two, I think has the chances of becoming a contender if they continue building on it. So, yeah, I love the Sixers. They're really, really fun.
I know. They are a fun group, and I think you, even if putting aside Embiid and George, you have this core with Maxey and Edgecombe and McCain as he gets back into the fold. That's very exciting for them moving forward. But ultimately, I mean, to your other point about, you know, if they had the opportunity to move Embiid or George, would they do it? I still would rather hold on to Embiid. I think with Embiid on a per-minute basis after his stinker of an opening night against the Celtics, he's been really good. He's been back to himself for the most part. It's just he's playing 25 minutes. You know, he's not playing enough. That's the issue. But ultimately, I think with Embiid, if they can kind of keep him in bubble wrap the whole year, just play him a little bit, you know, 25 minutes per game or so the whole season, and then unleash him in April. Hey, you know, I'm not ruling him out.
I'd love to see it. Sure. Yeah. If we get it, that's great. That's the thing. It's like, it's just the cherry on top here. You know, if they get that, then that's great. But if not, they have this guy in Maxey who they can now lean on as being their number one guy. And I think, honestly, over the last couple of years, he's proven that he can be that guy for them. It's just how they build out the rest of the roster. And to your point, if Embiid can stay healthy.
Yeah. I mean, Maxey so far this year, for people who haven't watched him, 32 points per game and 40.3 minutes per game. So he's playing heavy minutes, putting up highly efficient numbers.
Nick Nurse loves playing those minutes, man. Yeah,
he does. Yep. He, you know that from Toronto. 41.8 three-point percentage on 9.2 attempts per game. At 7.8 assists to only 2.5 turnovers as well. His playmaking has improved quite a bit. So very, very happy with Maxey's development. Let's move on to something that happened on Sunday. On Sunday, the Warriors got another win against the New Orleans Pelicans. And during the game, Draymond Green had a play during the first quarter in which he just, you know, he rebounded the ball a bunch of times in a row and, you know, missed each one of them, trying to get put back. And he missed all of them. And then, you know, during this whole, you know, the Warriors did score in that play for what it's worth. But after this exchange, there was a fan in the crowd that was calling him Angel Reese. He called him Angel Reese because of Angel Reese is an elite rebounder, but not an elite finisher in the W. And Draymond Green approached this fan, who is somehow taller than Draymond Green, by the way.
That is actually crazy. Him, wow.
Went face to face with this fan. And then after the game, Draymond Green was asked about what had happened, what transpired. And Draymond had a very interesting response, which let's go to right here.
What happened in the second quarter with that fan?
He just kept calling me a woman. You know, it was a good joke at first, but you can't keep calling me a woman.
He said,
"That's
kept that's calling wild. Me a woman. Kept calling me a woman's name, Angel Reese." He didn't mention Angel Reese, but he was being called Angel Reese. Did Draymond Green overreact us?
Yes, I think he did. Yeah. He absolutely overreacted.
The answer is always also, yes with Draymond. It is always yes.
It's always yes. It's also like a really weird thing, you know, I guess post-game comments, like the way he worded that was kind of weird to me. It's like that's the thing you caught from that. I mean, there are worse things to be called than Angel Reese, you know. Angel Reese is like a superstar WNBA player. Like, she's awesome. I don't know. Yeah, she's got her own shoe. Does Draymond have his own shoe? I don't think he does. No disrespect. Honestly, I thought that was just a weird post-game comment. That being said, I will say, do you see the Jimmy Butler interaction with the fan that was betting and he was yelling at Jimmy Butler? He's like, you were supposed to score 30 points, etc. Some of that stuff has now gotten over the top. That is weird. Some of that stuff is just way, way too far gone. And the fan interaction aspect has been weird this season, truthfully. We've had a couple of moments on and off the floor where guys are screaming at players because they didn't score a certain amount of points or didn't grab a certain amount of rebounds. And I do wonder how that kind of snowballs into something. I don't know, but yeah, Draymond did overreact. Very weird.
To your point about the Jimmy Butler one, sometimes in society you see why there were guardrails when you start removing them. You know, sometimes you see why. And I mean, we might be seeing that with when it comes to that. But we'll see over the course of time as that develops, because it doesn't seem like it's slowing down anytime soon.
Yeah.
With Draymond Green specifically, strange post-game comment.
Really strange. To your point. Yeah.
Very, very odd. Very odd. And he kind of just kept saying that it went along a lot further after the clip, after we cut it off, as well as the media asked him more questions. But ultimately, I think with Draymond, you know, he's playing engaged. He's energized after, you know, Tom Haverstraw credited me last week for turning it on with Draymond Green after he went it.
You did. Yeah.
Tom credited me. I'm not taking the credit, but Tom Haverstraw credits me for activating the Warriors. And Tom said Warriors fans should be thanking me. I think this all stems from that. Draymond's playing engaged. He's playing hard. And the Warriors are playing pretty good basketball right now. And I think for Golden State, they're in a position where you're seeing what this team could look like. Steph had another big game over the weekend as well.
Yeah,
Steph had 49. Tom and I talked about his 46-point game the first night against the Spurs, but then he has 49 the second time against San Antonio. Didn't even have a good game against New Orleans, 9 points on 2 of 11. But, boy, Stephen Curry doing this at 37 years old,
Yeah, it's absurd, man.
What a privilege to watch these guys at this point of their career.
Yeah, cool. It's a great time for the NBA. I mean, we were just talking about it before we started recording, but like this is a beautiful time for basketball just because the older guys are still competing. We just talked about how Kevin Durant's Houston Rockets are the number one offense in the league. Steph Curry is still dominating. LeBron James is about to come back. James Harden is scoring 40 points in double overtime. Like, these older dudes are still competing at all-time levels. And then you also have the younger players who are hungry, who are itching. You know, Victor Wembanyama looks like he's going to be the best player in the world eventually. You know, Luka Doncic is still MVP level player. You have these younger players who are ready to take the mantle, which is creating some beautiful basketball. Yeah, Steph is unreal. I want a playoff series. Give me Warriors Spurs for 7 games. I'm locked in on that. I need it.
I know. I just feel like, remember Bill Simmons said on his podcast last year, this is the first time in NBA history we've had four generations. And I'm not sure exactly how he split it up into four generations, but it does make sense. it does make some sense how he structured it. And I mean, it is just crazy. I mean, the fact you have Kevin Durant putting up big buckets down the stretch against Orlando and having huge games, and James Harden, granted the Clippers are losing, still having magnificent scoring performances, and Stephen Curry doing what he's doing. I mean, LeBron coming back soon. Like, we really are lucky that we have all these legends from the late 2000s, early 2010s that are still doing what they're doing, and all these other stars that have come up, and it's created a league right now, S, where it's like, I feel like as basketball fans, there's this perception sometimes, which is wrong, where people say, oh, nobody plays defense or everybody plays the same way. It's all about taking threes. It's like, no, the teams play dramatically differently.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was always nonsensical. It's like, how could you look at, like the, I don't know, last night's Utah Jazz Chicago Bulls game and compare it to the Spurs Warriors game on Friday night? It was like two completely different basketball games, two exciting basketball games, but they were played completely differently. Like the style, every team is doing things differently. You know, whether it's the Rockets crashing the offensive glass, whether it's the Warriors living off of cuts or the Hawks living off of cuts or the Raptors running in transition. You can't look at one team and say they all play the same. I just don't think that's true. It never was true. It's just a matter of like, watch the games, man. They're good. It's good basketball. That's
it. it never was true, but I think it's to an even greater extreme now. But because it's a byproduct of the players who enter the league, and that helps dictate the systems in which you play. I mean, we have more bigs. We have skilled bigs. So you have some teams that are playing five out, some teams that are crashing the boards and different defensive schemes, teams that are playing full court press like the Blazers, teams that are dropping back and playing a lot of zone. It's just different. And I think that's where, you know, the NFL a long time has always been really good at defining team culture, and teams have a personality. The NBA, I think, with, you know, you have the NBA on NBC now and Amazon. The NBA on NBC is doing a really good job with their pregame hype stuff, the Bob Costa style intros. I think over the course of the season, there's an opportunity for the NBA on NBC to integrate some of that team identity stuff, right? Yeah. Like when the Blazers are on NBC, I want that pregame hype video to talk about their full court press and their aggression. I want the Nuggets one to not just talk about Jokic and his beautiful passing. I want that one to talk about their zone defense. You know, I want that to be part of the conversation. I think, because people, and that's one of the things, you know, not to ramble on here, why I think sometimes with the jerseys, old man, you know, yelling here, there's too many alternate jerseys. Part of the identity is turning on the TV and seeing a familiar court in a familiar jersey and in a familiar style. And I think the NBA can, if it can shape identity with their broadcast partners for these teams that do have very clear identities that we're talking about, I think that over time will be really, really good and healthy for the game. Cause it's a great time to be an NBA fan if you're an NBA fan, but it's also a great time to gain new NBA fans if 100%. You just recruit them in. You know, that's what you get.
100%. Yeah. Dude, your point about the jerseys, by the way, I don't know if it's just me like liking the 90s and early 2000s, but all of these city jerseys have been awesome. They're actually better than the regular jerseys that teams are putting out.
They've done a good job. Timberwolves
with the tree jersey. Bring it back. Make it your permanent one. Take away the green court, though. That green court is disgusting. the Hawks, they have a cool city jersey. The Raptors are doing something. The Jazz yesterday had their purple mountain jerseys, which were awesome. It's one of the best
jerseys in all of sports.
100%. Be more creative. Like, that's the other thing, man. With your logo designs, with your jerseys, be more creative. Be willing to throw yourself out there. Get rid of the 2020s minimalistic design where everything has to look sleek and perfect and uniform. Just make it cool, man. Just make it cool and people will like it. I promise you that's actually a big part of it. Merchandise. You can sell some good merchandise if you commit to cool jerseys. That's all I'll say on that front. But I agree with you on the NBC stuff. Yeah.
What about the Raptor? The Raptor jersey. I want the late 90s Raptor on the jersey.
I would love that. Permanent. Count me in, man. Like, purple is a layup for the Raptor stuff. They should be really leaning into purple. I mean, that's like iconic with the Vince Carter generation and everything like that. But there's so many teams that should do that. Like the Hawks, bring back the big hawk over the chest, you know? Let's lean into that as the thing. Don't be afraid. The Celtics, throw a leprechaun on the top of that. Like, don't worry about being cool. Cool is overrated. Throw out creativity.
That is cool. That is cool.
Yeah. No. You know what I mean by cool, though. Yeah, like, we're too cool for school.
With the ball logos, everybody's got a basketball in their logo.
That's exactly.
Yeah. Move straight away from that and have some fun with just a regular hawk. This was a lot of fun to have you on the pod again, man. I think this is our first one since Vegas, right? We did Vegas, and definitely going to have you on again, though, man.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you, man. Thank you for having me on.
Where can our people find all your stuff?
Yeah, listen to us over at the Athletic NBA Daily. We do daily podcasts recapping the games. If you like the Raptors, if you want to cover and follow the Toronto Raptors, I do work for them at Raptors Republic, which is a YouTube channel, but also we do a lot of written stuff as well. So check me out there. Appreciate you, Kev. Appreciate you.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yes, sir.
Thank you to S. Barahini for joining me on today's episode. Be sure to check out his stuff. Does excellent, excellent work. Thank you to Emmy, Sarah, and Dakota for producing today's episode. Thank you to Father John Misty for the music. And I appreciate you giving us a listen today. We'll be back again on Wednesday. We have a special episode because I'm going to be in New York on Tuesday for the Champions Classic. And then on Thursday, we're going to have our draft class episode after Tom Haverstraw joins. So we got a busy week on the Kevin O'Connor Show. Thank you for giving us a listen. We'll be back again very soon.